ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Teresa Iacobelli's talk, Death or Deliverance, Canadian Courts Martial in the Great War. It was part of the Ottawa Historical Association's 2014-2015 speaker series. You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. I also especially want to thank the organizers, Ottawa Historical Society and Know History. And I want to thank Prest for hosting me tonight and for hosting this event. I'm going to begin the talk tonight by reading you a very short excerpt from The Introduction of Death or Deliverance, the book on which tonight's talk is based. On March 27, 1917, a cold wind blew and showers of sleet rained down in the small village of Mount Saint-Eloi, located in northern France. On this bleak day, a young Canadian soldier, 21-year-old Arthur LeMay, stood before a field general court-martial, the Army's highest wartime court. He had been there before. Having volunteered to serve his country less than a year before, LeMay had already been subjected to field punishment number one, a common yet humiliating form of public punishment. And I'm just going to interrupt myself for one second right there to show you the next slide. This is just a depiction of field punishment number one that I found in the files at the Library and Archives Canada. It just gives you it's sort of a how-to diagram. And field punishment number one was nicknamed crucifixion by the soldiers, and it basically involved restraint by handcuffs or fetters to a fixed object like a wheel or a post. And this was done in public view of other soldiers, and it was done for a couple of hours each day for a number of days on end. LeMay had already been subjected to field punishment number one, a common yet humiliating form of public punishment, for charges of absence as well as a previous court-martial and a reprieve death sentence for the crime of desertion. A mere 4 weeks after this last court-martial, LeMay once again stood before his accusers on two more charges of desertion. The odds were stacked against LeMay. His commanders and his fellow soldiers might well have believed that he would be among those shot at dawn. LeMay came from the 22nd Battalion, a group of men who later became notorious for their bad behavior and for their unforgiving commander, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Louis Tremblay. A three-time deserter, LeMay was already under a suspended death sentence. He had failed to prove himself in battle. His constant desertions meant that he had seen no action other than a little time spent in quiet sectors. His own commanders failed to find anything positive to present at his trial, and all of his superiors recommended that he be led to the firing post. After hearing the evidence and deliberating on their own, the members of the court-martial reconvened as LeMay stood before them. To the surprise of no one, a verdict of guilty, accompanied by a sentence of death, was swiftly passed down. All that remained was for the commander-in-chief, Sir Douglas Haig, to sign off on the sentence for the execution to be carried out. For an habitual offender such as LeMay, the deed seemed all but done. The hours that followed revealed otherwise. Haig ignored all recommendations and inexplicably, once again, commuted LeMay's sentence of death. LeMay was sentenced to 5 years of penal servitude, and within 6 months, he was free to rejoin his unit. And just as a footnote to that story, LeMay went on and he was to rejoin his unit, and he was killed in action on August 27, 1918. He was killed instantly by enemy machine gun fire during an advance, and today he is buried at Wancourt, here in Wancourt Military, British Military Cemetery in France. Now, I decided to open my talk and my book with that story because it encapsulates the project of Death or Deliverance, which is to revisit the social memory of executions and to do so critically. LeMay's story runs contrary to popular opinion regarding military discipline in the First World War. The conventional view has been that military discipline during this era was both brutal and unforgiving. But I wanted to know, was LeMay the exception or was he the rule? I wanted to know what saved LeMay and what, if anything, set him apart from other Canadians who were shot at dawn. I wanted to know what LeMay's case and others like it could tell us about military justice during the First World War, so I began this book in an attempt to answer those questions. Now, just in terms of a quick outline for tonight's talk, I'm going to begin by telling you how I came to this project and then introduce some of the popular misconceptions that exist around military justice. Then I'm going to talk about a little bit about the sources that I used to build my own arguments and explain the importance of the commuted death sentences of the First World War. And I'll then conclude by talking about the larger stakes of this project. So, to begin with, how I came to this project. In the summer of 2000, I was working at Canada's National Archives as an intern, and during the course of that summer, I had the opportunity to work on a project to preserve the service records of Canadian soldiers who were executed during the course of the First World War. The stories of those men intrigued me, and the experience was formative in piquing my intellectual curiosity about these events. At the same time that I was working with these records in the archives, the Shot at Dawn campaign was also getting a lot of attention in the media. Now, the Shot at Dawn campaign was a grassroots movement that was campaigning for official pardons for those soldiers who were executed during the First World War. And these were soldiers that were executed under the authority of the British Army Act, and that would have included Canadian soldiers. Incidentally, the name Shot at Dawn comes from the actual practice of the executions, which was to tie convicted men to a post and shoot them at dawn. The political agenda of the group was to gain pardons for the executed soldiers, based on the assumption that the British military was unfair and too harsh in the original handling of these cases. In total, there were 361 men executed under British authority during the First World War, and among that number were 25 Canadian soldiers. By far, the greatest number of executions were for the crime of desertion. Some of the other crimes that were punishable by death included mutiny and treason, cowardice and murder. In the case of murder, if a soldier was found guilty of the crime, it was an automatic death sentence without a possibility for commutation. In the Canadian example specifically, there was 25 executions in total. 23 of those executions were for the crime of desertion. One was for cowardice, and two were for murder. So by 2000, the Shot at Dawn campaign was already 10 years old. It was begun in 1990 by John Hipkin, who was a Second World War veteran and a retired school teacher. Shortly after its beginning, the campaign gained its first significant victory when a British Labour MP named Andrew McKinley took the issue before Parliament, and thereby giving the cause greater attention and a much wider platform. In 1993, McKinley asked the British Prime Minister John Major, a member of the Conservative Party, to consider a case for pardons. Major refused, noting that, and I quote, "There was no reason to believe that the original convictions were unsound." Major went on to say that the punishments needed to be understood within the context of the time and that any attempt to rewrite history was misguided. McKinley refused to accept that as his final answer, and he pushed forward. In 1997, the newly elected Prime Minister, Tony Blair, agreed to open the question of pardons up for a formal review. 1 year later, based on that review, Blair declared that pardons would not be forthcoming. His review had revealed that there was little evidence left from which to make new judgments, and the evidence that did exist supported the original convictions. Undeterred, McKinley and his fellow Shot at Dawn campaigners continued lobbying and increasing their public support. As part of that effort, media attention was actively sought out. Every Remembrance Day, articles appeared in major newspapers that bore headlines about young men who were shot for cowardice and championing the goals of the pardons campaigns. An online presence was developed, and the campaign spread to Canada and New Zealand and Ireland. In 2001, the campaign erected an impressive memorial to the executed in Staffordshire, England. And this is an image of that memorial. It's the same image that appears on the cover of the book, just the front side of it. And as you'll notice, there's posts behind the main memorial. And go to the next slide. This is just a close-up of the post. And each post is, there's one to represent each soldier who was executed. So in this case, this is one for William Alexander. Ultimately, in Canada, the question of pardons was settled in 2001. That year, the Minister of Defense made a speech to Parliament that began by acknowledging that military executions were lawful in the context of their time. With that said, the minister then went on to offer what was called an expression of sorrow for executions on behalf of the Canadian government. He also announced that the names of the executed would be added to Canada's official books of remembrance. And just by another way of explanation, this is an image of the books of remembrance. Basically, what they are illuminated manuscripts that list the names of all of Canada's war dead. And these books are housed in Canada's Parliament buildings, and each day a new page is turned over and placed in public view. It should also be noted that only 23 of the 25 executed Canadians were added to these books. The two Canadians who were executed for murder were never added. So while the announcement in 2001 effectively closed the campaign for potential pardons for Canadian soldiers, the British campaign pressed on. Then in 2005, the British High Court announced it would consider a pardon for the case of Private Harry Farr, an image here of Farr. Farr was a unique example among the executed cases in that he had surviving family members, in his case a daughter and a granddaughter, who were willing to pursue litigation on his behalf. This was a rarity. In fact, for the most part, the pardons campaigns were dominated by activists with no familial connections to the executed. For example, in the Canadian cases, the relatives of Stephen Falls were the only family members who were tied to the campaign to pardon Canadian soldiers. And as a result, Falls became the de facto face of the campaign in Canada. And this is an image, one of the few images available, actually the only image I know of of Stephen Foles. So whenever a story on pardons would appear in Canadian papers, it was accompanied by this image of Foles in his story. In the vast majority of these articles, the case of Foles was portrayed sympathetically. However, the irony in Foles and being the face of the campaign was that there probably couldn't have been a worse example to base a case for pardons on. Foles' personnel record shows that he was a chronic deserter. By the time he was executed, 1918, he was already on his third sentence for death sentence for desertion. His first two had been commuted. Also, the story of his final desertion, which was reprinted over and over again in Canadian papers, seems to have been completely false, and it was probably based on family lore but never fact-checked by journalists. Every year, the story was reprinted that Foles was arrested and executed following a late-night return to base after visiting his French girlfriend. Instead, what the record reveals is that Foles' final desertion occurred immediately after he was released early from a prison sentence. Upon release, he was ordered to grab a gas respirator and meet up with his unit and proceed to the front. Instead, he was not seen again until his arrest a little over a week later. So now returning to Harry Farr's case, the British High Court that was deliberating on it ultimately came to a preemptive halt in 2006 when the British government announced that not only would Farr be issued a posthumous pardon, but so too would all troops of the British Empire that were executed during the First World War. This, of course, included the Canadian soldiers as well. So with this announcement, the Shot at Dawn campaign effectively came to an end. What was one of the most interesting aspects to me about the pardons campaign was the emotive language that was used to press their points forward. While the language certainly had the intended consequence of arousing sympathy, I was particularly curious about how much of it was actually accurate. And I'm taking these quotes now directly from Shot at Dawn campaign material, and I quote, over 300 British and Commonwealth soldiers brutally gunned down by the authorities, not in the name of justice, but as a stupid, spiteful, shameful example to others. And again, I quote, most clearly suffering from shell shock. Most shot for subordination because they refused to put on a hat, fell asleep at their post, or were so terrified that they simply could not cope. And finally, and I quote, medical excuses not to be tolerated. It's these questions that led me to my own research and that would ultimately lead to the cases of the commuted death sentences that proved to be the backbone of death or deliverance. In total, there was 2,719 death sentences, including the sentences of 197 Canadians that were passed but then subsequently commuted during the First World War. That's approximately 90% of all cases. So upon learning this number, my first question was why? Why were the cases commuted, these cases commuted when others were not? And conversely, what was so special or unique about the cases of the executed? Were their crimes worse? Were they long-time disciplinary problems for their units? What exactly was it that set those men apart? When I began my research, I could find no real answers to these questions. In the Canadian case specifically, while there are secondary sources on the cases of the executed, besides a listing of the names of the commuted death sentences, there was no other information that discussed them. No one had looked at the commuted case files. They had been overlooked in favor of executions, which had a much more obvious and dramatic impact. However, I felt it would be these commuted cases that would be key to forming a broader understanding of military law and discipline during the war. These cases would dramatically enlarge the research base, and it was my hope that by delving into these 197 cases, I could begin to form a more realistic and nuanced portrait than what had previously existed in both the scholarship and the social memory of frontline discipline. So to conduct my research, I basically relied on three main sources of evidence. The first source of evidence were personnel files of every soldier that were included in the study, and that includes both the commuted death sentences and the executed. Personnel files included several extremely important documents. The first document were attestation papers. So attestation papers are the forms that every soldier filled out upon enlistment. And these papers included basic personal information regarding place of birth, residence, the profession, age, marital status, and physical traits. The second record I used within the personnel files were disciplinary records. Disciplinary records listed all minor and major crimes that led a soldier to face some type of punishment during his service. So that could be anything from a dock in pay for drunkenness to something more serious like a court-martial for desertion. The third source of evidence were medical records. And these records listed all incidences of physical as well as mental injury, as well as all courses of treatment and hospital stays. And I actually have several examples here. I'll start with this one. because there's various kinds of medical records. This was a field medical card, and as you can see, it lists some basic information that would have been discovered right away on the field. So this was a card for a soldier by the last name of Scholes. You can see it says GSW abdomen, so that's he received a gunshot wound to the abdomen. Really unfortunate about this particular card is that he died at 5:30 a.m. at 11/11/18, November 11th, 1918, so right at the end. The next one, this is a proceedings of a medical board, and this is a case for, if you zoom in a little bit more, a soldier that would have been facing a medical board for a shell shock. You can see it lists some of his symptoms under present condition, including the fact that he's easily excited and has difficulty sleeping. The next one, again, this is a medical case sheet for a soldier who received GSW to the hip, so a gunshot wound to the hip. And I think the next slide is just a close-up of that. Yeah, so. So my second major source material, other than the personnel files, were the court-martial transcripts. These transcripts have never been looked at systematically before by any scholar. Basically, what a court-martial transcript was a verbatim account that was handwritten, and sometimes, if I was lucky, there was a typed copy attached, and that recorded the court-martial. So this here is a page that lists, it's consisted of several different pages with different kinds of information. The court-martial transcript, this is a statement of the accused. So this is him speaking about the crime in his own words. This is one of those great typed ones. And this is just basically a verbatim account of the proceedings. So you see that the prosecution goes, and then there's a cross-examination. And so, considering that I dealt exclusively with field general court-martials, which were held in the field, I found it remarkable that these sources did exist in the detail that they do. And I should note that I only had the opportunity to look at transcripts from commuted cases because the transcripts from the executed cases no longer exist. They were at some point destroyed by the Directorate of History before they were actually transferred to Canada's National Archives. So these two sources together, the personnel files and the court transcripts, were really among my favorite sources to work with. Statistically, the personnel files were of immeasurable value. They helped me to compile information related to the background and the crimes of these men, but they also gave me information on other related issues, like the incidence of shell shock and how that may have contributed to the crime of desertion. Beyond that, though, they are my favorite because they are what actually personalized these stories for me and allowed me to feel connected to the individuals that are at the heart of Death or Deliverance. These records provided information far beyond numbers and broad trends. Using these records in itself became an act of remembrance for me. It provided me with an opportunity to recover and to tell individual stories of these men and to form a connection with who these men may have been. For me, these records illuminated the lives of the ordinary soldiers, and I found myself very attached to those lives. So there were some men in particular that stood out for me in the research and whose stories I'll share interspersed tonight. The first one is named Harry Townsend. Townsend grew up in Manitoba. He was a laborer in Manitoba before he enlisted for war in 1915 when he was 20 years old. His record before his eventual court-martial showed nothing out of the ordinary. Health-wise, he was treated for a bout of the flu in 1915 and an appendicitis in 1916. He had no major war-related injuries. In regards to discipline, Townsend had two relatively minor charges on his record, one for insolence and one for not complying with an order, both which resulted in a short-term field punishment number one. Then on September 27, 1916, Townsend disappeared from his unit while at the Somme. He was apprehended by military police 4 days later. At his trial, Townsend explained to the court, and I quote, "I remember going up to the Somme trenches for the second time and cannot say what happened after that. I don't remember being detailed to carry out the wounded men, nor do I remember going to Calais. I remember the sergeant at Calais asking me my name on the road. I have suffered from loss of memory before. The boys in my battalion know this quite well. All the officers and NCOs of my company have been wiped out. I cannot call them. The letter shown to me is in my handwriting. I wrote it in a dugout." Now, the letter that Townsend is referring to is what made this case stand out for me. What I ended up finding in Townsend's file was a suicide letter that he had wrote to his mother. And in the letter was actually confiscated upon his arrest and used against him at his court-martial to prove his intention to desert. And the letter stated, and I quote, "I do not want to carry on as a soldier and be shot at any longer. I am serious about wanting to kill myself." Townsend was found guilty at his original trial, but when the case was reviewed by a judge advocate general, it was found that in spite of the suicide note and the bouts of memory loss, Townsend had not been given a medical exam. Because of this, a final decision in the case was halted, and it was determined that Townsend's mental condition should be examined by a medical officer and then retried again. So that order was followed. Townsend was examined by a medical board and determined to be mentally fit. And although he was once again found guilty of desertion, his sentence was commuted and he survived the war. My third source of evidence that really made up this book were letters of confirmation. And this, I think you could probably go closer on that one as well. Yep. So once a death sentence was handed down, there was a process of confirmation that would begin. And during that process, there would be three letters written and sent up a chain of command for each soldier. The three letters came from the convicted soldier's battalion commander, the brigade commander, and then the division or corps commander. In each letter, these three men were asked to comment on a specific set of criteria. The first was the convicted soldier's behavior and his record of service. So, for example, how had he performed in battle and did he do his work willingly? The second factor was the state of behavior in the battalion as a whole and whether that battalion might benefit from an example being made. And when they say an example being made, what they're referring to is an execution. The third factor was whether the crime was deliberately committed. So, for example, was the soldier trying to evade a particular duty that was assigned to him? And the final factor were any other reasons on why a death sentence should or should not be carried out. So it was here that the commander could detail his extenuating circumstances. And it was also here that a commander was expected to give a firm yes or no answer to the question of whether they should proceed with the execution. So all of these letters would proceed in order up the chain of command, with the lowest ranking officer writing first, so as not to feel pressure from officers who outranked him. All three letters, along with the court-martial file, would end up at the desk of the commander-in-chief, who made the ultimate decision to execute or commute a death sentence. While the previous material I mentioned was so important for illuminating the lives of the ordinary soldier, these letters proved to be of immeasurable value in providing a fuller picture of military authority and taking it out of the realm of caricature that has become so common in popular media and memory. What ultimately came out of... Sorry for my voice, I'm getting over a cold. I can feel it breaking. What ultimately came out of all these records challenged popular perceptions of the First World War, as well as the rhetoric of the pardons campaigns. So I would like to spend the rest of the evening discussing some of those findings. First is the issue of shell shock. Shell shock is one of the defining images of the First World War, and it's an inescapable part of the social memory of trench warfare. And rightly so, the presence of shell shock certainly defined the trench experience for many soldiers. Throughout the Shot at Dawn campaign, activists routinely used the image of the underaged and the shell-shocked soldier to appeal to public sentiment. But more than using this image, the campaign also persisted in the argument that evidence of shell shock was routinely and as a matter of protocol ignored at court-martial. According to regulations, an accused soldier was to be assessed by a medical officer on each day of his court-martial. My own evidence does not show that this was the case. Instead, a medical exam was called for only when shell shock was used as a defense or when it was determined to be a probable contributing factor to an offense. Now, the fact that a medical exam was not called for in every single case is, I think, one of those facts that's important to remember in context. Medical officers were already overstretched in dealing with what the Army considered to be the more pressing and immediate needs of the physically wounded. Medical officers simply did not have the time to spare to attend a court-martial for every soldier in order for every soldier to be assessed. The fact that a medical exam was not given in every single court-martial is not, then, I believe, a cause for great concern, especially because there's no evidence to suggest that shell shock was ignored as a matter of a routine. We saw in the case of Townsend that when it was ignored in a probable cause, the case was actually retried. Even in cases where shell shock seems to have been a factor, but a soldier was convicted in spite of it, the confirming authorities used their opinions and influence to influence the final decision. In this way, the confirmation process actually acted as a de facto appeals process. For example, there's the case of Harry Sandlin, who deserted for 1 week in August 1918. In describing the night of his desertion, Sandlin stated at his trial, and I quote, "I was trying to hold myself, but kept losing control. I couldn't lay still. I thought if I walked around, I would be better. The first thing I know was in the morning when I lay in a dugout by a dressing station. Between leaving and when I found myself at the dugout at the dressing station, I do not know what took place and how I got there. I had been in France 23 months. I first noticed my horror of shells at Maricourt in April 1917. I was with a party at this show when half of us were lost and the rest were heavily shelled. I have never been the same since." End quote. The medical officer that was present at the trial stated, "I am of the opinion that on the 27th of August, the accused was suffering from shell shock." The representative for the defendant then asked, "Is a mental lapse a form of insanity?" The medical officer answered, "Yes." Despite that testimony, Sandlin was found guilty and sentenced to death. However, all three commanding officers recommended that a sentence be commuted. His battalion commander wrote, and I quote, "From personal knowledge and from reports of his company officers, I do not feel that this man is capable of carrying out his duties under fire. He is a cheerful, obedient worker out of the line, and I am certain that he makes every effort to overcome his weakness, and I do not believe his crime to be deliberate." End quote. His divisional commander recommended that the sentence be remitted and that Sandlin be transferred to some branch of service for duty out of the line. Sandlin's death sentence was commuted, and he did survive the war. Another common perception from the Pardons campaign, but also persistent in the social memory of the First World War, is this idea that leadership was ruthless and unforgiving. The fact that 90% of all death sentences were commuted, I think, alone challenges that assumption somewhat. But the documents that I researched do so as well. They show that for the most part, there were good officer-men relations that were rooted in paternalism and trust. In order to help foster and maintain this relationship, when suitable, battalion commanders dealt with disciplinary issues on their own, rather than immediately referring to more official channels that would result in a court-martial. This often helped to strengthen the camaraderie between soldiers and their commanders. Even when crimes ended in a court-martial, the letters of confirmation that followed a guilty verdict continued to demonstrate that military leadership was not a ruthless monolith. Instead, letters reveal that commanders were sympathetic to a variety of factors, including youth, shell shock, drunkenness, and even one case I found, opium use. In November 1917, Arthur Thorne was 33 when he enlisted for service in 1916. And Thorne was a person who never would have been accepted earlier than that. His medical records upon enlistment showed that he had poor eyesight and a previous back injury. In November 1917, Thorne was absented from a forward area, and he remained absent for over a month until he was captured by military police. Thorne claimed to be a imposter that whole time. While he was found guilty of desertion at trial, his commanding officers all argued in favor of commutation. And while they argue for it based on some typical reasons, like good battalion discipline and a fairly good record of service, two letters also mention Thorne's use of opium as a reason for a commutation. His battalion commander wrote, "I strongly recommend that the extreme penalty should not be inflicted for the following reasons. He must have been regarded as trustworthy by a former stretcher-bearer sergeant who entrusted him with the destruction of damaged opium. When fatigued, Thorne suffered pain from an old injury to his spine, and as a result of curiosity, found that the opium relieved him temporarily." His brigade commander went on to write, "I do not consider his action one of deliberate desertion, but from the evidence of the medical officer, may have been influenced by the use of opium." Thorne's death sentence was commuted, and he returned to service. He was killed in action during an advance on August 1, 1918, along with 18 other soldiers and 5 officers. What these letters reveal is the genuine care that existed between men from the lowest level of command upward. Where possible and appropriate, commanders worked to protect their soldiers from the excesses of military justice. That said, I do want to make it clear that I didn't come across any evidence that suggested military commanders were against the use of the death penalty as a policy. They were products of the early 20th century Britain and Canada, where the death penalty was still in use in civilian society. Most of the commanders believed that the deterrent effect of the death penalty, and they were happy to have the tool at their disposal when they felt like they needed to use it. Finally, the last myth of the Pardons campaign that I would like to address this evening is the idea that all of these executed soldiers were denied fair trials, or to use the language of the Shot at Dawn campaign, that they were subject to summary executions. Records show that this just was not the case. Court transcripts reveal a system that in most ways mirrored trials found in civilian courts during the same period. That was no small feat considering the wartime conditions that these trials were held under. As the name suggests, field general court-martials were held in the field, but they would have been held in areas removed from danger, so in places like abandoned farmhouses and taverns. This is the closest I could find to an image of a court-martial. This is actually not even a court-martial of a Canadian. It's a sketch from the Canadian War Museum, and it's a sketch of a German POW being questioned, but you can tell it's sort of being taking place near the front, but in an abandoned little safe place. So that's the closest I can come. There are no photographs of court-martials. So while it is true that these trials may have been somewhat ad hoc and hurried, they never failed to follow a formal procedure. Trials were called to order once 3 officers were in attendance and sworn in. The accused would be led into the room, hatless and in restraints. Charges were read out, and the accused was asked to enter a plea. As of 1915, in every case where the death penalty was a possibility, the accused was actually required to enter a plea of not guilty, so that all evidence would be heard and that a fair trial could be conducted. The prosecution would then begin their case. The prosecutor was usually a senior officer, and they would state the facts of the case and call on witnesses. Once the prosecution rested, the defense made their case. The defense case could be presented by the defendant himself, or what was called a prisoner's friend. And a prisoner's friend was somebody who was chosen by the defendant himself. So this could be somebody with legal training, if that's who the defendant chose, or it could just be a really good friend that they trusted who had no legal training. The defendant began with a statement presenting their case, and then they had the opportunity to call witnesses. They could call witnesses both to the crime as well as character witnesses who didn't necessarily have to have any knowledge of the crime. Once the case was presented, the three officers of the court-martial were left in private to deliberate. Unfortunately, those meetings were secret and unrecorded, so it's impossible to know what was said or what those conversations may have sounded like or what factors would have figured most prominently in their decision. What I do know is that the most junior officer present was required to speak first in this meeting so that his opinion would not be influenced by higher-ranking officers. When a decision was reached, the accused was led back to the room and immediately given a verdict. On the whole, 89% of all defendants were found guilty. In some cases, the accused was found guilty of a lesser charge. So if a soldier was being tried for desertion, he could possibly be convicted of absence without leave instead, and that did not carry any possibility of a death sentence. If a soldier was found innocent, he immediately returned to his unit. If the soldier was guilty, he was given an opportunity to then make what was called a statement in mitigation of punishment. And this statement was typically a plea for mercy, in which the soldier often apologized and detailed extenuating circumstances. So he might make a plea based on his youth or on the fact that he was the sole source of financial support for his family back home. They also often made pleas based on their record of good service. Reuben Smith, who had a very interesting case, made such a plea. Smith deserted in April 1917, and he remained absent for 2 months. During that whole time, Smith never actually left the forward area. He lived in empty shell holes, and he survived off food left in abandoned trenches. Before that incident, his commanders noted that Smith had a good record of service. Hoping to save his reputation and himself from death, Smith pled to the court, and I quote, "I would urge your consideration of my record of service, of the fact that before the charge, I have not failed to do my duty faithfully and honorably to the king and his cause. I am anxious to go on in the service to be given an opportunity to redeem myself, to spare the 2nd Canadian Battalion from being discredited by any action of mine, and to try and maintain its reputation of which I am proud, and to fulfill the pledge I made when I enlisted." Smith's death sentence was commuted, and he did return to his unit. In a footnote to his story, he actually deserted again 3 months later, and he was never found. He was struck off strength as a deserter, and from there he disappears from the record. There's no indication that they ever found them, so he could still be in France. once the guilty soldier had made his statement of mitigation, he returned to his unit to await the final decision on sentencing. The verdict was read to the soldier while on parade with his unit, so in that moment, standing beside his peers, he would learn his fate. If commuted, he would be given an alternative sentence of either hard labor, penal servitude, or a prison. The sentences were typically commuted either immediately or within a few months, and then the soldier returned to service. If guilty, the soldier was led to a cell to await his execution. I'm not going to go into detail on the execution part of this because that wasn't really the focus of the book, but this is just to give you an idea. This is a document that was present in every case for the soldiers who were executed, and basically what it does is outlines the procedure the night before the execution. So it says things like that the soldier should have access to a religious person to hear their confession, that the soldier should be given paper and a writing utensil so he can write his last letter home. So that's, and it also lists the time of dawn the next morning so that they could have the precise time when the soldier would be let out of his cell and executed. So all of the transcripts I reviewed followed the same general pattern, but this pattern, and it was a pattern which in many ways mirrored civilian trials of the period, were on the receiving end of a number of criticisms by proponents for pardons. Among these criticisms were the speed with which these trials were conducted. And to that I would say, yes, that they were speedy, but that was the express purpose of a field general court-martial. They were meant to be faster and more simplified versions of regular court-martials that would allow the Army to provide a fair trial while not interrupting the running of the war. They were created to suit the context of the situation and to operate successfully in wartime circumstances. And I think it's wrong to assume that a slower trial would have been any fairer. As more time passed on the Western Front, more witnesses could be potentially killed or wounded. So a distinction must be made between a speedy trial and a poorly run trial. It is undeniable that these trials were quick, but it's harder to find evidence that they were improperly conducted. Transcripts show that defendants clearly had a voice and were given multiple opportunities to state their case. In this case, quick justice was not synonymous with rough justice. Another criticism has been the 89% rate of guilt in these trials. But when citing that rate, it must also be remembered that cases were typically only brought forward when there was overwhelming evidence of guilt. More often, the time and manpower required for a court-martial often dissuaded commanders from using them if an offense could be handled within the unit itself. The process of researching and writing Death or Deliverance reinforced to me the pathos that is evident in the story of all these soldiers which stood before court-martial. But it also revealed to me that the story of a cruel or harsh army is overly simplistic. Instead, what stood out in the records was just how much the evidence challenged this long-held assumption about military justice. Records reveal a system that could be characterized as flexible or fluid. Of course, there was always some flexibility in an army that arises as a result of unofficial actions and the individual wills of commanders. This flexibility is necessary in a large military organization, especially during wartime, when discipline needs to be more carefully considered against requirements for manpower. However, more surprising than these unofficial disciplinary measures was the amount of flexibility built into the official military legal system. This flexibility was present at each echelon of power and authority. It has been a common perception that military discipline during the war, and to some extent now, has been both rigid and oppressive. It has also been assumed that authority was concentrated at the very top. Yet the commuted death sentences provide a very different view. During the First World War, there was a great amount of leverage in the military judicial system. While the courts martial were run according to protocol, in their letters of recommendations, officers were encouraged to voice their personal opinions, opinions that more often than not were sympathetic to the errant soldier. Furthermore, these letters of confirmation and decisions that followed them revealed that the opinions of battalion officers were of just as much value as the opinions of brigade and division commanders. In fact, I would argue that the opinions of battalion commanders were actually more influential, since they were usually based on a more personal knowledge of the soldier. And I found numerous instances where the battalion commander's letter was quoted word for word in the following commander's letters. They were directly taking their words from them. In contrast to popular perception that military justice was brutal and that the commander-in-chief's power was absolute, power was actually diffused in this system. Commanders at every level of authority had a role in negotiating on behalf of or against the soldiers under their command, and they were not discouraged from sharing their general concerns regarding discipline. Their opinions were valued and thoughtfully considered. Although the commander-in-chief was indeed the final arbiter in any death sentence, it was rare for him to act in contradiction to his subordinates' recommendations. And if he did, it was often in the name of mercy, as we saw in the case that I mentioned at the beginning of Bartholomé. All that said, I'm not going to leave you with the impression that the system was perfect. It was far from it, and in fact, at times, downright arbitrary. This gets us back to the original question of why some men were executed and others were not. One would assume that with only a 10% rate of confirmation, that the death penalty was reserved for only the most serious crimes or the most delinquent soldiers. But this was not the case. In some instances, as in the case of Stephen Foles, yes, repeat offenders met their death by firing squad, but so did some first-time offenders. Ultimately, executions had far less to do with individuals than with circumstances of war. Personal disciplinary records meant very little in determining if a death sentence would be confirmed or commuted. Outside factors that were beyond the control of defendants proved to have the greatest influence on that decision. And the two biggest factors were the state of discipline in the battalion and the timing of an offense. Letters of recommendation prove over and over that the primary concern of commanders at every level of authority was the discipline of the battalion. In a battalion where behavior was faltering and desertions were rampant, commanders used executions to reinforce discipline. Even if a soldier was not the worst among his peers, if he happened to desert and be convicted at a time when an example was needed, he became vulnerable. This need for an example also manifested itself during particularly important phases of war, including immediately prior to or during major offenses. Soldiers who deserted as 0 hour approached or in the midst of a long engagement took a particular risk in comparison to soldiers who fled during relatively quiet periods. During these tense periods, as fears heightened, commanders wished to reinforce that desertion was not a viable option, and they were willing to reinforce that through executions. To close tonight, then, I would like to say what I sought to do in Death or Deliverance and to do tonight was to challenge some of these existing preconceptions about the First World War, while also conveying to you the texture of some of these personal stories. Telling the stories in a way that is true and fair has not just been an intellectual exercise for me, but also one that carries a moral significance. The military leaders and the old ordinary soldiers are not simply caricatures or statistics. They were individuals who lived harrowing experiences and made tough decisions. To boil them down to anything less than that is to minimize their full experience. I wanted to investigate the rhetoric of the Shot at Dawn campaign in order to provide a fuller portrait of the lives lived and lost. It is my feeling that the Pardons campaign at times actually minimized the stories of the individuals by painting their experiences in broad strokes as victims and villains. As a result, the casualty was often context and facts. So it was my hope to reintroduce more truth into the social memory into this one small aspect of the war.
You've been listening to a recording of Teresa Iacobelli's talk, Death or Deliverance, Canadian Court Martial in the Great War. It was part of the Ottawa Historical Association's 2014-2015 speaker series. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.